welcome to a brand new episode of the Sports Bro podcast. My name is George Breer. I'm head of events content here at Sports Bro. And as ever, I'm delighted to be joined by my co-host, Mr. Tom Bassam. Good to be joined by you, as always.
Yeah, nothing changes, really. Fortunately, it's not just me. We are also joined by Sports Bro reporter Josh Sim. Welcome, Josh.
Thanks, guys. Thanks. Good to be here.
Gents, a very exciting week, this one. It's what I like to call Christmas Eve. It is the night before the Cricket World Cup. Very exciting. Are you both going to be tuning in?
Yes, obviously. How could you miss such a big sporting event as the Cricket World Cup? One of the top 15 best sporting events in the world, I'd say. George is rolling his eyes now. This is literally his Christmas.
Christmas, Tom. Please call it by its correct name.
Okay, mate. Whatever you say. I do really like the Cricket World Cup, actually. I think with any of these big events, I don't know if you guys are the same, but I always think back to my first one that I can remember watching, which is, for me, the 1999 Cricket World Cup, which not only dates me as a slightly older person these days, but was also a pretty tragic tournament for England, I think.
Great kit, though.
Great kit. Yeah, great kit. Josh was not born yet?
1999. That was the year I was born. So
huge year.
Huge year in the Sim household.
Not a big year in the ECB boardroom.
No.
Well, Josh, it's a minor miracle that you've agreed to come on today's podcast. I know that when it comes to cricket and your Aussie heritage and our English heritage, it's usually a bit of a grudge match, but we'll put those differences aside for this week.
For a month more, at least.
For sure. So looking ahead to this year's tournament, it's being held in India, starts on Thursday, the 5th of October. So by the time this podcast goes out, I believe the first ball will have been bowled between England and New Zealand. Josh, it feels like a pretty important tournament for a lot of stakeholders involved. What's your take for this year's World Cup?
We've spoken about this in the past with regards to sort of the battle regarding the revenue distribution model. It does feel like we are reaching a moment where there's some big traditional cricketing countries that are not at this tournament. Only 16 countries are there. It does feel as though this, I don't know, it does need maybe a moment to sort of solidify itself and keep itself going in the sort of upward trajectory, because there's so much noise around sort of the future of the game.
In many ways, it feels as a really important turning point. Either this can sort of be seen as cricket's last hurrah on the international stage and as the World Cup being the pinnacle of the sport, or I do think there is another opportunity to bring some of those stakeholders together, some of those marginalized countries together, and see it as a bit of a springboard going forward. It's being held in India, cricketing's heartbeat, really. And there's an opportunity to really build on that and to capture that IPL audience and to really bring it on the international cricketing journey. But I think there is also a big, big risk that we see the gradual decline of other countries that have been marginalised by the revenue distribution model, by sort of the rise of T20 franchise leagues, that this really is the last time that they're fielding full strength 11s and that their international boards and setups are properly funded for success.
I sort of feel like, George, you'll probably be the best person to speak on this, given you are Sports Pro's resident Mr. Cricket. Another face. Wow. If only you could see the daggers that I'm getting in the studio right now.
That's why we go audio only.
Could you like drill down into some of that? So like, how have we got to this point? Where are we at? Like, what's the status with the ICC? What's going on with India? Why are some major cricketing nations not here?
Yes, that's a big question. The reason why they're not there is the ICC have done a different route qualification this year to previous years. So I believe all test playing nations were automatically included as part of the World Cup pool stage, essentially. And then there was a qualifying tournament for associate nations to be involved. This year, that hasn't been the case. So not all test playing nations have had automatic qualifications. So the likes of Ireland, the likes of Afghanistan, the West Indies, Sri Lanka were involved with other associate nations in a pre-qualifying tournament. So there's been a two-year cycle where all test playing nations have sort of been in a league table, and the countries I previously mentioned were the ones that didn't gain automatic qualification through that league table, and that has meant that some pretty major names have missed out this year. And the biggest name of that group is the West Indies, you know, a country of incredible cricketing heritage, a phenomenally talented side, but one that performed incredibly poorly in the qualification tournament, so they won't be there, which is a pretty major blow, I would say, both to the West Indies and to world cricket. And you desperately hope there's not a sign of things to come, but potentially is. So there's that side of it. What also feels like an important moment is the revenue distribution model. That's sort of been announced for the upcoming cycle. And to put that into perspective, so South Africa, one of the most historically rich cricketing nations, a phenomenally good side, they're due to be distributed with $26.24 million as part of the next rights cycle. If you look at India, someone that already has recently signed a $6 billion broadcast deal, for instance, with the IPL, that's $231 million. So it's just simply a case of the rich are getting richer and those marginalizations will continue to be underfunded.
We're not a publication that is anti-capitalist, I wouldn't say. What's the argument against India getting that money? Like, to me, they're the biggest nation. They bring in the most eyeballs. They bring the most revenue. Why shouldn't they get that money? Or is it a case that even though they should get the most money, that current model is so skewed that it puts out of whack pretty much everything else in the cricketing ecosystem?
It's a good point. From like an economics point of view or mathematics, India is actually under receiving what it's due in terms of a percentage split of what it contributes. So, and if we just look at the 2019 World Cup, 706 million people tuned into the tournament. India were 545 million of that audience. So that's 77%. Australia, which is the third biggest recipient when it comes to that revenue agreement, they're just 6.1 million. So India's well over 100 times bigger in terms of audience tuning in. And that comes with, you know, immense revenue. Disney Star are the host broadcasters for all ICC events. By the end of the next cycle, will have been for the past 20 years. So there is a valid argument from a simple economics input-output scenario where India received the lion's share. Where that argument begins to fall short is that there won't be a competitive tournament with which to gain these eyeballs, with which to sell these broadcast rights to, if the West Indies aren't involved, if Cricket South Africa aren't involved, if Australia and England aren't involved in an extreme scenario.
Yeah, it goes back to our important. You can't play yourself. No one's paying to watch that. And I think that's a strong one as well. Is there a case that they actually need all of that money to support all of their grassroots stuff? Or is it literally just a case of this is slightly greedy on behalf of the BCCI? Or is it like, not as black and white in that?
Yeah, I don't think it's as black and white as that, to be honest. I think this tournament is a real flashpoint in those relationships and in this development of the way that cricket is going. I mean, there's been talk over the past year of contracts being signed with franchise leagues by players, which essentially would require national boards to request permission in the same way that the FA does with Premier League clubs to bring players into the international setup. So there is a significant shift in the balance of power now. And this World Cup definitely feels as if a bit of a tension in that regard. Ultimately, the composite boards of the ICC are in competition. India haven't won a major tournament since 2007. So you can understand why the BCCI don't sit there and say, let's behave like a charity and let's make our rivals even stronger than they already are and continue to beat us in world tournaments. You can understand the want for a competitive differentiator. And South Africa have a good chance of winning the tournament. They are more than capable. They have a squad that's more than capable. So there is that sort of competitive tension. I think it's when it comes to the long term. And in the long term, it's going to be very damaging for those national boards.
I think South Africa are an interesting case in point in this. So they've launched that SA20 competition, a rival to the IPL. I mean, basically every T20 franchise competition is a quote unquote rival to the IPL. How real that is kind of in the eye of the beholder and will ultimately be proved out on the balance sheet. But what Cricket South Africa have been saying is, well, we're going to start prioritising that over the performance of our national teams in ICC events. We were talking about this previously, George, and you highlighted the case that they could well be fielding a fifth choice test team with the idea that not just that, like, the South Africa players playing in their SA20 competition, but also like any players contracted in that competition won't be playing in that league as well, because it's happening at the same time. The absolutely bizarre side of this is that like quite a lot of the franchises in that competition have got Indian investment or have got partnerships with the Indian franchises or owned by the same owners. So it's a very strange ecosystem where you've got these things pulling it one way or the other. Josh, from your perspective as a younger cricket fan, would you miss the World Cup? Like, do you think it's important? Is it relevant in today's cricket ecosystem?
Yeah, in my view, yeah, I love these sort of national team tournaments. I feel like it really brings people together in a way that in which these franchise competitions haven't yet sort of, with the exception of the IPL maybe in India, haven't yet sort of mastered. obviously there's national pride thing going on when you want to win the tournament, but also it's exciting to see these sort of countries, especially so many of these being traditional rivals for so long, sort of come together and do battle on the latest edition on the cricket field. So I think it would be a big miss if it was no longer to be an event on the calendar.
The calendar is the thing here, right? Like, the calendar has got a lot of things in it. We've lost the Champions Trophy, RIP Champions Trophy. But we still have a T20 Cricket World Cup, which happens all the time. I can never keep up with when that is. And you've got the 50-over competition on top of that. All of these bilateral series, which are increasingly less and less relevant, especially when they're being competed by B teams, essentially, half the time. And within that cycle as well, which we're rightly trying to make room and trying to find attention to get people to focus on the women's competitions, like, and growing those as properties as well. It feels a little bit like kind of something's got to give. And George, does that make you feel like this is why you perhaps framed this tournament as a bit of a last hurrah?
So the World Cup is a bit of an outlier when it comes to 50 over cricket, speaking from a purely English perspective here, but Jos Buttler, England's captain, gave an interview a couple of days ago where he said the series they've recently concluded against New Zealand was the first time their first choice 11 has played together since the 2019 World Cup final, which is a pretty extraordinary point of view when you consider they're building into what's supposedly the pinnacle of the game. It has been marginalised for years. It will continue to be marginalised for years in the bilateral world because it has to be. As you say, something has to give. And the 50-over game is the natural one. You look at someone like Harry Brooke as well, again, purely from the English perspective, or anyone really in the English setup, they don't play 50-over cricket domestically, let alone internationally. So someone like Harry Brooke has played, I think, 5 or 6 50-over games ever. And, you know, he's been seen as this guaranteed starter. So it's not something that is a fabric of the cricketing ecosystem anymore. As I said, it's an outlier. It is the pinnacle of the white ball sport internationally. So there's no bottom to it, right? There's no foundations with which this tournament is being built on, which is why it does feel a little bit like a, not necessarily a last hurrah. There's World Cups that are planned up until 2031 at least, and broadcast rights sold, and for a significant sum as well, and a significant uptick as well on the current cycle. So there is clearly interest there. What it feels like is that this is going to be a tentpole moment that is different in years to come to the way it is now. It may well be one of the few tournaments that brings together international teams in the same way that the footballing ecosystem works. I mean, I've been saying for many, many months now that cricket is moving into that football structure, and it definitely feels as if the World Cup is going the way that the Football World Cup does.
Well, it's probably a good point to talk about some of the innovations at the tournament. To be fair to the ICC, it's not been standing still when it comes to this kind of stuff. It realizes that engaging young people is important, and it's probably quite glad to be hearing Josh saying that he's fully signed up. But that also comes with doing some more interesting things. So I mean, the ICC has its own tech innovation accelerator program. I think one of the more interesting things that they announced recently, aside from the fact that it's going to be offering equal prize money for the men's and women's tournament, which I think should be applauded, is they're now going to be rolling out vertical feed productions for this tournament. Josh, I don't know if you can just give us a little bit more detail about what the ICC are planning here.
Yeah, so they're working with Disney Star, who we've mentioned as sort of the official broadcast of the tournament, and their vertical feed is going to use a lot of split screens in its coverage, as well as sort of dedicated vertically oriented cameras to capture, I guess, the action in this unique format. They're going to be bespoke production enhancements and match graphics as well on the feed. And they're also going to sort of be able to tailor sort of their previous innovations, such as ball and player tracking as well, for the vertical format. It's used in football, WNBA, a lot of leagues have sort of revamped their apps to incorporate a lot of vertical storytelling. So it feels like a natural step for the ICC to experiment with this.
And for those less au fait with broadcast technology, what is the difference between vertical video or vertical format and others?
In simple terms, it's basically you pick up your phone and you don't have to change the angle of it or hold it with two hands to watch the game in that format. Cricket, I imagine, will work quite well. The focus of the screen, if you're watching a game on a regular TV, is very much just a stripe down the middle. For that bit alone, it's probably quite good. It'll be the kind of capturing of all the other stuff that's interesting. And like, you do have to have dedicated cameras for this, and you have to have specialist crews for this, because otherwise it just looks dreadful. But done well, I think it's got the potential to make sure that this stays relevant to people. And actually, the fact that they're doing it now says that the ICC are onto something here, because I mean, we haven't seen this rolled out so dramatically in other sports. And this is, as we've been discussing, still the pinnacle of the white ball game in cricket, still highly relevant, still going to get loads of people watching it. And in India, like, mobile viewing is a really important distribution platform, as is seen by the kind of the demand for the digital rights to the tournament.
On that note, an interesting innovation from the ICC, but this is a hugely important tournament for the host broadcasters, Disney Star, as well. It's the final tournament in their existing cycle. They have renewed on a 3-year deal up until 2027 at a significant increase in value as well. But it's almost the last jewel in the Disney Star crown when it comes to holistic rights. So the IPL has fragmented between the linear and digital rights. So Viacom 18 have been a very aggressive and powerful new entrant in the market, buying up the digital rights for a pretty mega $3 billion fee, which is a 50-50 split between linear and digital on the valuation of the entire rights portfolio. They've also pretty incredibly bought the linear and digital rights to all bilateral cricket, although that's actually a lower amount than the previous cycle, and probably goes to what we were saying in terms of the reducing importance of bilateral cricket. But it means that the Disney, who have really been the kingpin of cricket in India, have had the bilateral rights, the entire IPL rights over linear and digital, and all major tournaments, now really just have the linear IPL rights and the major tournaments. So this kind of has to work for them. And we have heard reports that they're looking potentially at a sale or a joint venture. We've seen significant churn of the Disney Plus subscriber base on the back of those IPL rights going to Viacom 18. So it does feel like a hugely important tournament for them to retain that viewer base and to sort of maintain their market share.
This is all against the backdrop as well of Disney potentially looking at a sale of that Star India business too. Like Viacom 18, a Paramount joint venture, could well end up being the ultimate buyer of that business, which would then bring back all of those rights into one place again, which I think, like, for consumers, that's great. Maybe the BCI is hoping that doesn't happen, if only to get some competition in the market. As you said, George, like, it is a bit of an inflection point for this kind of stuff. There's a big bet to make this work. I think it's probably exaggeration to say this is do or die for them, but it is certainly an important thing, and they need to be hitting those big numbers that you were previously mentioning for the last tournament. That might be a good point to kind of go on to the final question in this section, I think, anyway. What counts as a win? What counts as a win for the ICC? What counts as a win for the BCCI? And what counts as a win maybe for Disney Star too?
I think there's a potential for some incredible numbers in terms of engagement and overall viewership. So the 2011 final, which India won in India, that pulled in 550 million viewers. I genuinely wouldn't be surprised to see that number almost double if such a feat was to happen again, and someone like Virat Kohli was to score 100 in the final. I genuinely wouldn't be surprised to see the billion in global viewing. So there's the potential for that. And if those numbers are hit, almost everyone's happy across the board. Sponsors would be happy. I know that Disney put a sort of a £40 million target from an advertising perspective on the broadcasting. So again, if those numbers are being pulled in, you'd think they'd hit that with relative ease. So I do think it's about those overall numbers. And what will be interesting as well to see will be the digital take up. And we saw in the IPL this year, especially as Viacom 18 through the GeoCinema app had the content is free to air. It'd be really interesting to see what Disney does. And Disney actually followed suit with, I think it was about 10% of their games on the linear channels. It'd be really interesting to see what they do with the digital side of things and whether they do open it up to being free to air through the Hotstar platform.
That might be a decent place to leave it. But before we do and go on to part two, maybe we should just get a couple of predictions. So
Josh and I are smiling at each other, Riley.
Yeah. Let's go with winner, star player, big off-field storyline. So I will let George Breer go first.
I can see Josh has already had a sigh, so I know he's thinking hard. Winner, it's always a battle between my head and my heart, Tom. My heart says England, the best team probably in the tournament, but my head and my heart to an extent says India. There's probably nothing better than watching cricket in India, both on TV and in stadium. And I would, in a way, quite like to see the whole country rallying behind them, the incredible atmosphere that you get on the back of it. And their team is just so ridiculously good. So I'm going to go with them to win. My star player is going to be Mohammed Shami with the ball. think their batting is so good, but Shami just consistently is unplayable with the new ball. And my significant off-field story, how widely reported on it is, but I think there's going to be some logistical challenges with the tournament. So there've already been significant challenges to date. So for instance, tickets for the India-Pakistan game at Ahmedabad only went on sale a month ago. I believe the internet actually collapsed in many parts of the country due to the demand. And there's a requirement for all fans to collect tickets in person the day before the game. And with skyrocketing accommodation and flight prices and previous stories of that not going so well for the IPL final, I think that's going to be a pretty major logistical challenge for the organisers. So that, I think, is going to be my major off-field story. I wouldn't be surprised to see a Rugby World Cup or a Champions League style difficulties with entrance before those games. Yeah, I hope it doesn't happen at all.
Josh.
I mean, this is going to be quite quick. I have India winning the tournament. I think Virat Kohli is going to be the star player. It will just add another sort of bow to his already glistening sort of legacy in Indian cricket.
He's going to be fired up.
He always is.
For sure. And then off-field issue, I am going to sort of turn my attention to the upcoming India-Pakistan game in the middle of the month, just because we know how intense that rivalry is. We know that sort of police in the local area are still trying to sort of make sure they get all the arrangements set up for that game, because we know, again, just how intense that rivalry is. So I obviously hope that there's no incident that comes out of that game, but you have to think whenever those two teams play that there's always a massive risk something does.
I believe no traveling fans for that game as well because of visa challenges and visa denials, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yep, that would chime with the current leadership of India. So I'm going to go with England to win, just to have a nice little split around the table. Star player, I am going to pull out Harry Brook, because obviously England are going to win.
Wow, he's not even going to start, Tom.
Well, you say that. Something's going
to
happen.
I'd love to be proved wrong.
Yeah, he's going to take over.
You've been washed away by the hype train there. That's a mixed metaphor, I know, but that shows where my head is right now.
And then in terms of off-field storyline, there will be a significant on-field issue related to the laws of the game, which will require careful governance, which won't be provided.
A good old-fashioned man-catting in a crucial moment of the game.
I don't want to be that specific. I'm just saying on-field issue, which will require governance, which will fall short. That's it. It's a nice cheery prediction to end that round.
Welcome back to part two of the Sports Pro podcast. Now, Tom Bassam, I know you talked to me about your weekend watching the Solheim Cup and how much you enjoyed that on your Sunday. Was that replicated with the Ryder Cup?
Yeah, it absolutely was. I enjoyed all 3 days of the Ryder Cup. I don't know if anyone was in the Sports Pro office last Friday. It wasn't the most productive day because the Ryder Cup was on the big screen. And by the end of the afternoon, when Justin Rose was coming down 18, it's fair to say that everyone's attention was on that rather than our scheduled tasks. From a European perspective, results-wise, obviously fantastic. The whitewash on the opening session, great to watch. Love to see an American failure. Hello to all our American listeners. But yeah, I mean, just purely from a kind of like overall big picture moment for golf, like it's great. It has something that no other competition has apart from the President's Cup, which no one really cares about.
And shots being fired early doors.
Sorry, like they haven't, like it's... For a competition to be a competition, there has to be some competition, and there is no competition in the President's Cup. So, but the Ryder Cup does have competition, albeit recently that's been dominated by the home team. But this was a very, very strong-looking American team, multiple major winners, lots of big names. There was lots of confident predictions beforehand about how they were going to turn the tide and they were finally going to get that win in Europe, and they didn't do it. And it was great watching. There were some great storylines in the middle of it. Hatgate. And Max Homer going into the water in his final round. Wyndham Clark doing the same thing after telling Rory McIlroy he was better than him. There was just like so many little things throughout the whole competition which made it like compelling watching. And I will give Sky credit. Their broadcast was fantastic. The way that the course was set up made it great TV. There was amphitheatre kind of greens on a lot of holes. Marco Simone Golf Club in just outside Rome looked phenomenal. I've heard that the broadcast for the US on NBC was subpar, which is a real shame because that's one of the things that makes it great, is that the broadcast on Sky is so good. Why I wanted to talk about the broadcast and that comparison is because of the comparison with George. You mentioned the Solheim Cup already. And we had Joe Osborne on this podcast very recently from Sky talking about how they want to build up their women's sports properties. You got to call a spade, and they didn't put their money where their mouth was when it came to that production. The difference in quality between the Solheim Cup broadcast and the Ryder Cup broadcast was night and day. Like, there was far too many ad breaks in the Solheim Cup for what's a broadcast on a pay TV network. There wasn't shot tracking. There were missing shots. There were missing holes. There were missing whole matches. It was like everything that was good about the Ryder Cup broadcast was almost bad about the Solheim Cup broadcast. Like, you got the kind of the key moments and that was it. And that's not good enough. And that's partly to do with the host broadcaster, like the agency like given the brief to do that. Partly to do with the course, I think, as well, that they played the Solheim Cup on. It wasn't the most accessible. I heard it wasn't the best for fans. This is all secondhand reporting, having not been at either event myself. But that it's not unfounded, I don't think, those criticisms. They're kind of widely written on. It's a shame that we had this 2-week moment of brilliant team golf where you get so much attention and one was fantastic and one failed to reach those standards. And unfortunately, the one that failed to reach those standards was the women's competition.
Yeah, well said, Tom. I would completely agree with that. On a slightly lighter note, one thing I did find quite amusing was part of the commercially branded like statistical insights that were delivered by the broadcasters before each hole, one of which was the team that drives further wins this hole 50% of the time. So the takeaway being, whether you hit it miles or not, you're either going to win or lose.
That's one of those stats that you think when you first fit, oh, yeah, that's really smart. And then you think about it for like 2 seconds and you're like, hang on, what?
Start panicking as John Rahm shapes up, like, please hit this far because then you've got an equal chance of winning or losing, as you did before you took that shot. I did find that very funny, but it was a fantastic tournament. As you said, Tom, we covered the issue of co-programming a lot with Joe Osborne at Sky. We talked about the benefits a lot, but as Sam Karp said on this podcast, I think last week, actually, it can sometimes really shine a glaring light on the property that is being underinvested in and undervalued from external partners. And that was definitely the case between the Ryder Cup and the Solheim Cup.
Yeah, and the thing is, the Solheim Cup, lots of people watched it. Yeah. 734,000 peak viewership on the Sunday, which is 30% up on the last edition. The averages were up around 400,000 a day. Sky saying their digital platform's got 3.7 million views, like the editorial content. Increases all around, and unfortunately those increases got to watch not a great TV product. So yeah, fair play Sky, you've got more people watching it, but the next Solheim Cup is obviously in the US, that's next year. Then IMG are going to be taking over the kind of the hosting, like management of all of that stuff for when it comes back to Europe in the Netherlands in 2026. So by then you'd really hope that they've kind of got their act sorted out and we're seeing the same, we're seeing the Solheim Cup get the same treatment as the Ryder Cup, because no doubt it deserves it. They were both unbelievable events. I mean, one ended in a tie, one ended in a European win, but like they were both great bits of sporting entertainment, and unfortunately one was just slightly better produced than the other.
Imagine how many more people would have watched it.
Well, yeah, or imagine the people who may be put off watching next time.
For sure. Josh, final note on the Ryder Cup. It saw the reintroduction of the LIV Golf players. Any implications from the LIV Golf PGA Tour proposed merger you see ahead of the next edition in 2025, and any risk to the Ryder Cup on the back of that?
It's funny. I mean, we talked about sort of Ryder Cup as an event, like the whole event, the whole weekend, no one really focused on the cloud that surrounded golf over the last year. It was great to sort of focus on a sporting story, and that included not having LIV Golf sort of mentioned a lot, obviously, other than, you know, Brooks Koepka is right there. I imagine they'll want to take that tournament away from, like, just holding it in another, probably Saudi Arabia, I imagine. It should that merger go through if the PIF really wanted to. And I'm sure that there may be other sort of changes, but I would advise them, if I had any influence with the PIF, would be to sort of leave that product, just watch that product as it was last weekend and sort of keep it as much as they can the same, just because it was just a great story. It was a great sports story that focused on sort of the things on the course, and obviously there was sort of dramas off it, but it didn't really get in the way of what was a really great competition.
I'm going to propose a slightly alternative view to you here, Josh. If you were the PIF, surely you'd be looking at the Ryder Cup and saying, having launched a golf series or a golf organization that has a team element to it, surely you can see the perfect blueprint in front of you of what golf really needs is that match play style format, that investment behind the teams, and bringing that atmosphere as an all year round product because it needs it. And I cannot understand why golf doesn't have more match play. Every time I think this when I watch the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, it's an argument you hear over and over again on the broadcast as well. And there's loads of slots in the calendar they could do it. And maybe this is where the live element of this merger goes, whether or not that happens, because there were some interesting developments at the back end of last week on this subject with reports of the PGA Tour potentially looking at investment from Endeavor or FSG and some other private equity backers too. So with the kind of like wink, wink that maybe all isn't quite going as well as it should be with the LIV Golf negotiations. But like to your point about match play golf and team golf, there's one of the most confusing things about LIV Golf is the fact that it's a team competition, but no one cares about the teams. Like the players are all kind of, they're basically there for themselves. But as for match play being a more regular feature, it seems to me that's the obvious play here. Like when you see what it does and like Europe as a team, this is the only European team I can think of in anything. I guess the only kind of copy is the Laver Cup in tennis, but that's a relatively new thing and also modelled on the Ryder Cup itself. Like it's a kind of unique thing. Like we're sitting in the UK. The UK technically left the EU, but yet when it comes around to the Ryder Cup, we're all on board with it. It's, it goes to show that it doesn't necessarily have to be like the most natural fit in the world. It's just a team competition that people buy into. So yeah, there has to be a place for it. There's so many ways that they could do it. And I think if they don't do that, if that isn't part of this LIV merger, then they've made a big mistake.
Well said, Tom. And up the match play golf. another story that has been of particular interest to me over the last couple of weeks, particularly in light of a proposed session at Sports Pro Madrid 2023, is the Liga broadcast tender that is in play. And in particular, Canal Plus is positioned within that. Tom, can you give me a bit of background to that story?
Yeah, sure. So Canal Plus has been a broadcaster of the League One for, I mean, going back to the late 80s, I think. In the last right cycle, it lost out to MediaPro, the Spanish agency. MediaPro then had a massive collapse. Like taking the League One rights was all part of a big play to get into the French market. MediaPro is a Spanish agency at heart. And that meant that when this came around, the LFP and Canal Plus had been in various different legal arguments over the last 3 years about how much Canal Plus was paying for the rights, whether Canal Plus would take back the rights after Media Pro fell apart. Then Canal Plus weren't happy when Amazon snapped out the rights at what is below the per match fee that Canal Plus was paying for Liga. It's just been a bit of a mess over the last few years. So when Canal Plus issued a statement, or a senior exec came out and basically said recently that they're not taking part this time. And that is a blow because Liga LFP, they've set up this new commercial venture with CVC, basically with the idea that they need to grow their revenue from media rights. And if one of the biggest pay TV networks in France is saying we're out, then that's a big time problem. I guess the only caveat to that is that being a major pay TV operator is that Canal Plus carries other sports networks on its platform. So DAZN, which recently made an entry into the French market as a standalone, but also with its linear channels are carried on Canal Plus. And then Canal Plus's Liga is carried on DAZN streaming platform. What you could potentially end up here is DAZN maybe buying up the league rights directly, but Canal Plus still having it on their pay TV platform by the nature of having the DAZN channels on their service. That's the only way I think currently, or I mean, barring another entrant into the market or a BN coming back in, for example, that you're going to see significant Liga on Canal Plus's pay TV network.
How big an impact do you think that will have on the overall number, Josh?
It's definitely not going to create sort of the intense market that the LFP wants. We know they've sort of set out their stall. I think it's €1 billion they're trying to get in total. And it just feels as though they're at risk of being lowballed, essentially, from, you know, whoever else is still in the race. We think it's Amazon and DAZN, and maybe someone else does pop up. But I mean, wider picture, it will remain at a significant gap from the Premier League. We know that Canal Plus has renewed its rights to the Premier League.
That announcement was basically made side by side, wasn't it? Yeah. Which felt intentional.
Yeah. And maybe it kind of goes to show, maybe it was a bit of an FU from Canal Plus to Liga in these kind of talks as well. I don't know, Josh, if you feel the same way, but from my perspective, like if you're looking at a league from Europe's top table that should be feeling under threat from the Saudi Pro League, it's probably Liga.
It does feel as though there's been a bit of a talent drain to the Saudi Pro League over the summer. It's slightly on a different topic, but Italy's undergoing the similar problem at the moment in that they have pushed back sort of their sales process because they are still trying to find offers that sort of satisfy their demands, I guess. And yeah, it's pretty shocking that Canal Plus was sort of ready to sort of come out and say, you know, we're happy to keep the Premier League, but, you know, say to LFP, no, thank you, essentially.
At least you could say with the LFP, they are set up better to succeed than Serie A. Like Serie A is kind of a bit of a disaster of its own making. It can't get out of its own way when it comes to broadcasting. The sort of general infrastructure has not been developed. Serie A's stadiums are crumbling down. It doesn't look great. There's just not been a lot of innovation in that competition. Whereas Liga, as with the help of CVC, at least, is trying to modernise and is trying to do something different. They've brought in Ben Morel, who, as you mentioned, George, is going to be speaking at Sports Premier Madrid.
On this exact topic.
Yeah, to modernise, essentially, what they're doing and make sure that they do kind of deliver on this commercial partnership. There's some skin in the game from not just the clubs, but also from a big private equity firm in making sure that happens. So it can't be accused of standing still, but at the same time, this feels like a body blow ahead of what are some crucial talks.
I guess it also would then mean that Ligue 1 could be one of the only European soccer leagues to sort of have live games exclusively on a streaming service, really, like not on linear TV, if it is going to be Amazon and DAZN, which I know you can still watch highlights on like on their sort of free-to-air broadcaster, but that's, you know, it's a sign of where I guess things are going in the sports broadcasting industry. Yeah.
We've not seen a lot of numbers out of like Amazon for what their Liga and broadcasts are getting on Prime Video. Like, you don't know whether or not that's probably them not being particularly proud of them, or they just sort of don't want to share that information because it's commercially sensitive. I mean, you'd say probably it's somewhere in between the two.
Which is even worse news for the LFP and Liga, surely.
Yeah, potentially. But then you've got to think that Amazon, I think having made that entry, they would probably want to keep it as long as it's not been a massive disaster, because like ultimately it still has the potential to be something really big. And if they can get that at a cut price, then why not try? Football is massive in France. Club football is huge in France. The clubs themselves get massive gates. There's still interest. It's just making sure that it just needs a bit of nurturing, because if you don't, you end up in a position like Serie A where you've got Inter Milan and AC Milan unable to basically modernise because they're tied to this relic of a stadium because the local authority can't get out of its way to make it happen. Like, that stuff just doesn't happen in the Premier League and hasn't happened in the Bundesliga. And even in La Liga, they've been much, much more proactive in terms of getting clubs to focus on infrastructure and modernising their operations. These are two countries where they should feel under threat from the Saudi Pro League, and maybe it will be the thing that kicks them into action.
It's interesting to compare the cases of Serie A and Ligue 1, because when Serie A essentially pushed their rights process back as they tried to drum up a bit more interest, reading between the lines, it was all quite smoke and mirrors and confidential and required a lot of reading between the lines. Whereas with Ligue 1, Canal Plus came out loud and proud saying, we've got no interest in this, we bought up the Premier League instead. So a question to you both. A, why prioritise the Premier League over the rights in their home market? And B, to your point, Tom, I'm not a fan of conspiracy theorists on this podcast, but here's a bit of one for you.
It's not the Joe Rogan show after all.
Given that DAZN is carried on Canal Plus, is this essentially a way of getting a cut price deal to broadcast the same content anyway?
So on that first point about why they'd focus on the Premier League, like, you focus on the Premier League because it's almost a mini Super League in itself these days. Like, a lot of French players, the broadcast times and availability is very broad, like very easy to get access to. It's not in the middle of the night. It's literally over the channel. So that's why that property is important there. And it's becoming increasingly important in loads of markets overseas. That's to the Premier League's credit and to the detriment of all of these other leagues in having not been able to do the same thing. On the point about a conspiracy theory, I mean...
That was tongue-in-cheek. It's not actually a conspiracy.
I know. But like, I don't think it's necessarily even that deep. I think it's potentially just a play. Like, they know that if you want to be taken seriously and actually get the market share that you need in order to make that investment in Liga viable, you would probably need to be carried on Canal Plus. That was actually one of the major problems for MediaPro with their Le Foot channel, was that they didn't get that. They weren't able to get the broad range of distribution for their Ligue 1 channels that were required. They couldn't get the subscription numbers up. They couldn't get the advertising revenue that they wanted. It just didn't work out because they didn't get that distribution piece right, which is a tale of old as time when it comes to a, a new broadcaster entering a market. You just have to look at 11 here when they tried to come in with some golf rights and the UFC. It just was like, wasn't happening.
Viaplay as well.
Viaplay too, yeah, more recently. So yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a conspiracy. It's just an angle they're taking. They're like, we're not going to directly pay you, but someone may well.
Well, I think, and I could sit here and talk to you gents all day about the Cricket World Cup, the Ryder Cup, and the state of media rights across Europe. But sadly, I think that's all we have time for today. Josh, thank you very much for joining us as usual. And I would say good luck to Australia during the Cricket World Cup. But that would be a barefaced lie.
I can't wait for the post-mortem in a month's time.
Neither can we.
Yeah, and then we can finally put our rivalries to bed for a few months over the winter. Tom, as always, delighted to be joined by your smiling face. I'll see you next week.
You shall. Pleasure. Cheers, guys.